Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Georgina Godwin. This week, we're taking a trip to the Bridge Theatre in South London for a brand new play by Martin McDonagh, A Very, Very, Very Dark Matter. It's been met with mixed reviews so far, but to throw in their 2 cents or krona, I'll be joined in the studio today by Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times, and Monocle's own Augustine Macellari. Thanks both so much for coming in. Now, of course, I say krona because this is set in Denmark. Is that, in fact, the currency of Denmark? I'm not sure. Martin McDonagh is an Oscar, a BAFTA and a Laurence Olivier award-winning playwright, a screenwriter and a director. He's had a prolific career so far. In the 90s, he was very widely described as the first dramatist since Shakespeare to have had 4 works professionally produced on the London stage in a single season. He's probably best known for his cinema hits in Bruges and 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and on stage for his Galway-based trilogies and the very successful run of Hangman, his 2015 production. So his latest play, A Very, Very, Very Dark Matter, chronicles the life of the man responsible for many of the fairy tales we still tell today, Hans Christian Andersen. It stars Jim Broadbent as the Danish writer and explores what inspires him to create these stories that often had a much darker twist than the versions we tell today. So, Matt and Augustine, if we start with you, Matt, more generally knowing McDonagh's work and hearing the premise of the play, what were you expecting when you went in?
Well, I was expecting something quirky, eccentric, perhaps a bit bitterly funny, off-kilter, all the things that you expect from McDonagh landscape, maybe taking no prisoners about different nationalities, different ethnicities. He likes to throw verbal hand grenades into the midst and see how they detonate. And all of those were in evidence, but I can't say for me that they added up to anything remotely satisfying.
And Org, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I would. I mean, my experience with McDonagh's work has been limited to film until now. Obviously, I've known him as a playwright and have similarly got these ideas that he's not afraid to make an inflammatory joke that maybe might kind of bait the sort of PC police, as the horrible contemporary idiom describes them, that he's unafraid of being provocative. Quite how provocative he was going to be with the kind of plot as well as the sort of language he used, maybe I wasn't prepared for.
Well, it was very provocative. And in fact, I think some of the reviews said that he was too obviously eager to test the boundaries of what audiences find offensive. There was a lot of swearing and all the rest of it. Now, one very big part of the plot, we're talking about Hans Christian Andersen, but this all centres on somebody that he keeps inside a box, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, really, I suppose the story at heart is a parable of cultural appropriation. I think that's what Martin would probably say it is. And the thesis is that, you know, great writers may not be the creators of their own art. And we have, on the one hand, Hans Christian Andersen, on the other hand, Dickens, principally Hans Christian Andersen, who, if McDonagh's extraordinary narrative is to be believed, was actually sort of channeling the work of this female Congolese pygmy who he kept in a box, in a cage in a loft for 16 years, whose name is Marjorie, and who's an extraordinary presence played by an entirely unknown African-American actress with a wonderful name. Her name is like something out of a Faulkner novel. It's Janetta Eula May Ackles, and I think her name alone deserves an Olivier Award.
And she's getting lots of praise, actually. It was her debut performance, and she was very, very good, wasn't she, Org?
She was indeed. I mean, I think it's important to clarify with the plot, you know, he's not channeling the work of this lady in the box. He's stealing it. Yeah. She's writing the work and he's taking it. And not only is he taking it, he's reworking it. So, you know, the play opens and there he is reading from his latest magnificent story, The Little Mermaid. As we later find out, it wasn't named The Little Mermaid. It was named The Little Black Mermaid. He erases the blackness and he erases Marjorie's writing from the work as it's then presented to history.
And, of course, Marjorie's real name is Mbuta, which he refuses to say until quite near the end. Now, what Marjorie is trying to do is to return to the Congo to stop the genocide that's about to be committed by Belgium under King Leopold II. And so there's a lot of time travel in this.
Yes, which I thought was incredibly clunky and didn't seem very artfully integrated. Which was odd, because one of the things about Martin McDonagh generally, particularly in his plays, is that he's able to sort of weave a seamless narrative, however bizarre, within the parameters of weirdness, it has an inherent logic. And this was the first time in any of his plays where I felt that the different seams weren't very well sewn together. It felt, dare I say it, as if it was a draft away from completion. But maybe when you reach his status, you just give it to a theater and a theater puts it on. That's what you get when you're an Oscar winner.
I think you're very right about the kind of the flabbiness of it, the lack of logic. You know, you have all of these different elements that combine and they're not harmonious. They don't add up to this kind of great comic sort of triumph. Instead, they all slightly jar with one another. And maybe, you know, maybe that's intentional. I will just say that I thought, you know, at the opening, so shortly after he reads this Little Mermaid story, the stage goes red. These two terrifying, scarred figures covered in blood sort of step out from behind curtains and prowl around. And I did find that atmospheric. And at that point, you know, having read some comments about the inadvisability of his inclusion of this time travel motif, I thought, well, maybe this works. You know, maybe this is like, it was menacing. And then there's a kind of pleasant bathos to the way, you know, as it breaks down, these two men are revealed to speak in broad northern accents and a kind of a pair of buffoons, really. But you're right, it lacked a kind of tightness.
I'm glad you used the word bathos, because I thought one of the interesting things, and this is actually sort of a thematic with Martin's work in general, is that for all the putative offensiveness, there's a great stream of sentimentality that washes through his stuff. I think it's there in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, definitely. And I think it's definitely there here that actually Marjorie, the one-footed Congolese pygmy, is quite sentimentally conceived as almost the equivalent in this of the Frances McDormand character in the movie for which she won an Oscar, i.e. kind of the rabid voice of truth amidst this world that degrades and revolves her at every turn. And it just, in this case, it just doesn't feel earned. It feels entirely kind of applied.
The whole Congolese aspect of it, I felt that there was a really wonderful opportunity here to really probe colonialism, to have a look at racism and all the rest of it, which really wasn't taken advantage of. I felt that that was part of the play that really I wanted to see so much more, that this was kind of thrown away.
I completely agree. I mean, for me, that whole element of it just served to function as a kind of metonymical thing whereby, you know, the audience was given this uninterrupted view of the sort of pathetic face of patriarchy, which is Hans Christian Andersen, who kind of slopes around pathetically making snide comments in the, well, we'll get to the end as we go through it, I'm sure, but you know, who doesn't present as any sort of powerful figure, but rather whose passivity enables this like terrible set of conditions to endure. And you know, what we had was the Congolese genocide used as a kind of lens through which to critique that. Almost that was what Hans was set up in, a kind of opposition to somehow. And it felt like the horror of the Congolese genocide was sort of interchangeable. Like, it could have been any genocide, it could have been any moment of colonial barbarism, because why was it that one?
And it's so glibly introduced just to lend a kind of fake gravitas to proceedings. I would have, frankly, got rid of that altogether and said something interesting about the relationship between Dickens and Andersen. You know, two characters who, for heaven's sake, this play is 80 minutes. It's the shortest by some measure of Martin McDonagh's plays. His last play, Hangman, which I think is a masterpiece, ran a full hour longer and felt about half the length of this one. Time in the theater is such a deceptive thing. But it actually felt, this felt strangely padded to me. It was a very long 80 minutes, as if having come up with the idea, he then didn't really know what to do with it. And also, if I can just say something about the language, I'm the most open-minded person in the world. You can throw anything at me on stage. But, and you know, I've seen many a David Mamet play where every third word is unrepeatable on air. And that's fine, because that's the landscape of that play. But I just thought here, you know, barely has Marjorie, the pygmy, been introduced before she's saying things we can't say on air. And Dickens is more or less defined entirely by being sweary. And you just thought, it seems so juvenile.
Ork, do you feel that this was an appropriate discussion to have by this writer, by these actors in this environment?
I certainly think that it was problematic. I mean, the casting less so, but from the writer's perspective, I couldn't quite understand McDonagh's interest in this complicated and terrible historical event and how he kind of had justified to himself channeling it through a narrative that was kind of so confrontational in its PC baiting. You know, there's this terrible historical event which killed 10 million people and was the fault of King Leopold and the Belgian army. There's Hans Christian Andersen, who is keeping a black lady against her will chained up and forcing her to work. We didn't even note that he cut her foot off. You know, she has one leg because Hans Christian Andersen has removed the other one, which I found really unpleasant. That was one, I think that was the most unpleasant bit for me. So he's mutilating her. And, you know, the things that it's forcing us as the audience to challenge, you know, the way it's making us think about the jokes we're laughing at, are they the right thing for a successful, rich, white playwright male to be asking us and to be exploring himself? I mean, what did you make of it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm always wary of us legislating what anyone can or should write about. I mean, you know, they should write about whatever they want as long as they can legitimize it. But I think I just felt that it wasn't earned. It all felt grafted on. And it felt as if there was maybe a slight guilt factor in McDonagh himself about appropriating this material, that the whole play was weirdly trying to work out, and it works out very glibly and sentimentally.
What we also haven't mentioned is that Dickens, too, kept a pygmy Congolese woman,
as we discover,
who is in fact the sister
of Marjorie.
Yeah. And I suppose one thing that slightly horrified me about that is that it comes up that he has had some kind of sexual relationship with her, and this is Dickens, not Andersen, and that clearly would not have been consensual, and that kind of rape is rather laughed off, I felt.
It definitely isn't. It isn't kind of interrogated. And there's a lot of those moments, you know. It asks us to laugh, and maybe, you know, maybe the nasty aftertaste is what he's going for. And I think that is legit. You know, I think that's an interesting point.
You know, one of the criticisms that came up with Three Billboards a lot, and it's a film I enjoyed, but a lot of people felt that the black characters in it were peripheral and not very well explored. For instance, McDormand has a sort of black female friend in the film who seems to just be sort of window dressing. And maybe Martin McDonagh is trying to expiate that a little bit with this play. I don't know. It's hard. It's impossible to tell where plays come from.
Also, what is his obsession with little people?
I mean, and cutting off hands, because we've seen that in his work.
Well,
he
had a play on Broadway which has not been seen here. Sam Rockwell was in it, called A Behanding in Spokane, in which a character keeps a briefcase full of mutilated limbs. Don't go to dinner at his house.
It was very interesting, though. I thought the way that he had Dickens and Hans Christian Andersen speaking to each other. So obviously, Andersen is speaking in Danish and Dickens is speaking in English, but on stage they're both speaking in English. And I thought that was absolutely magnificent, the way it was written and the way that it was performed. You got a real sense of these two people speaking in completely different languages, but of course you could understand everything they were saying.
I think that was great. And that was where a lot of the laughs sort of were for me. I have to say, I'm a big fan of the poetry of swearing. I like the rhythm of it. I think that well-used swear words can kind of light up dialogue in a really beautiful way. And you know, they don't have to be used sparingly. I have no qualms at all about hearing all the effing and blinding under the sun. But for me, all this was effing and blinding.
Yeah. There's no poetry in this.
You know. Yeah, there wasn't. And there wasn't a kind of...
Well, it was very funny sometimes.
Did you think?
No,
I was disappointed
so.
By the dialogue. I thought that the jokes
felt
a bit flat.
It felt kind of frat boyish.
Yeah, yeah. I have a very pure sense of humor. Can we talk about...
I'd love to have been to see it with you, Gigi.
Can we talk about the casting? Because I interviewed Jim Broadbent a little while ago because he has... he has a new graphic novel out, so he's very much into all of that dark stuff. It's called Dull Margaret, and it's all about Bruegel's painting. Griet Margaret is the painting, I think. But one thing I learned about him also at the time is that he carves wooden puppets. And this had a magnificent set full of these carved wooden puppets. And it felt to me, knowing Jim's, the fact that he's drawn to dark matter, if you like, and his obsession with puppets, that actually this play may well have been created for him.
I don't know, but I would imagine so. I mean, you know, Martin McDonagh likes to have a kind of ad hoc community of people with whom he works. And Jim Broadbent was one of the leads, not the only one, in another great Martin McDonagh play, which was, hard to believe, 15 years ago, I think. And that was a play of his called The Pillow Man at the National Theatre, in which the central character is a fictional writer, not an actual, you know, historical writer, in an imagined police state in Jim Broadbent, David Tennant, and Adam Godley were the leads. And so I suspect he and Martin struck an alliance which continues to this day.
Yeah. Now, I know that you, Org, also interviewed Jim about, in fact, the same book, that there did seem to be a theme, didn't you find, running through from the book into the play in a way?
Yeah, I definitely agree that, you know, before reading the book and before talking to Jim, I think that I had, as probably many people will, this slightly different perception of him as an actor. He's very much a character actor. He will be most recognisable to a lot of our listeners from his roles in family films. You know, he's kind of famous to a younger audience from his role in Harry Potter. I first saw him as the dad in the Borrowers film, which is an unsung masterpiece, I think. And, you know, as with so many of these guys, and understandably, that isn't who those are roles. And in fact, he does have this slightly darker sensibility, quite morose, quite thoughtful and weighty, and obviously isn't put off by the more malign things. And it did look, you know, as he was playing it, he was kind of having fun, because Hans as a character isn't just brainless. I mean, a lot of the reviews have kind of highlighted his sadism, and that's there. There's this kind of dumb, bullying meanness that on Jim Broadbent's kind of quite gentle features is somehow amplified. Whether or not it came, you know, this role was written for him, I couldn't say either, but it definitely suited him, I thought.
It's a good way of putting it, because there's something about Jim Broadbent, which I he's an actor, first of all, I absolutely love, and he always seems very benign and kind of gentle. So when you see him working out of that realm, it's kind of shocking. And, you know, at the beginning of this play, there's a remark he makes about her, of Marjorie, where she's described as a tiny Tim, only African and not as funny. And you think, huh? And then that's coming from this guy. It's odd though, the way the character is conceived, because he's almost conceived as kind of a stand-up comic, you know, in front of the curtain, just doing his shtick. And there isn't actually much of a character for him to play until he gets to the Dickens scenes, even though he keeps thinking that Dickens is Darwin.
Which in itself is, I found funny, but clearly.
That I thought was kind of funny, I have to say.
Dickens is played by Phil Daniels, I thought very well. What also really interested me in the casting was Janetta Eula-May Ackles, who was playing Marjorie, or Imbula, her real name, because she was, as the play says, a one-legged pygmy. So you're trying to cast a short black woman with one leg. Janetta is all of those things. Yeah. What are the chances? Surely it must have been written for her.
Yeah, I mean, she was completely amazing, as you've said already. A real revelation. I thought that she just was so charismatic on the stage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty good with actors, and I'm one of these people who runs to read press releases about upcoming plays because I want to see who's in them. And Jim Broadbent was attached to this very early on, Phil Daniels and Elizabeth Barrington and some British names we know. But I think she's not long out of drama school, and this seems to be her professional stage debut. And this is an extraordinary showcase for her, really extraordinary. And she's got real muscle on stage. I think that's the thing. One doesn't need to be sentimental about her. She really does hold the stage very, very well.
Let's talk about direction, because it's Matthew Dunster. Now, I know that you've known Matthew for a long time. I first encountered him when he was an associate director back at in the Young Vic a long time ago. He's come on in huge leaps and bounds, and now really one of our most trusted hands in the theatre. Was it that his work was below par, or was he doing a really sterling job on a script that was below par?
Well, you know, he directed Hangman, and Anna Fleischler, who designed this, also designed Hangman. Hangman had an incredible, incredible set for which it won multiple awards and had, you know, a coup d'etat in the first half hour, which I won't give away in case anyone ever sees it again. But I felt here that it was a sympathetic set of collaborators who were slightly stymied by what they'd been given to work with, and so had decided that when all else fails, go for the atmospherics. The set is incredibly atmospheric, seems like something that, you know, a Tim Burton movie might run towards. And it's obviously spare no expense. The bridge has money. And I'm not quite sure what else you could have done with it, short of ask for a rewrite.
That tarantula was really magnificent.
Yeah, that was a great tarantula.
So Mbula carries around, goes around the stage, and she has this incredible prop, which is this this tarantula that sort of serves as, what's the word? It's almost like a familiar as she kind of traverses the stage. I thought it was excellent. I'd love to hear your reflections on the puppetry, though, because that was something that I was struggling with a bit to kind of unpick. What did you make of that?
It felt to me like something that was added to the production to just give it some heft, to give it some visual heft, because actually, and I feel like I'm beating a dead horse here, the play itself seems very, very slight. And that's another way into it, to have this crepuscular design, to have Tom Waits, of all people, on the soundtrack, which you're, you know, kind of introducing it. And then for a not very long play, there's an announcement midway through, here comes the second act, and it's going to be cheerier and more upbeat than what went before. And you think, what went before has barely begun yet. And now you're telling us about the second act. So I sort of thought the puppetry was all an attempt to just give it some sort of three-dimensional life.
Org, go, stay away.
I think give it a miss, save the money.
What would you say?
Definitely stay away.
I'm saying absolutely go. It's really funny. But also, I think it's got some really important things to say about the Congo. And we'll get onto that in a minute, because I just want to ask you what for you it sparked in terms of in terms of other things. So each week on this programme, we like to talk to our guests about something that the topic reminds them of, and for them to point us in the direction of something related that might pique our interest. So you've chosen, in fact, Matt, another McDonagh play.
Well, I was talking about The Pillow Man, definitely, because I think that's a masterpiece. There had been talk of it being revived. And I think now with, you know, there's so much talk about, you know, the news itself is a narrative. So what narratives do we choose to tell ourselves? And that's exactly what The Pillow Man is about, set, as I say, in a fictional police state. It would work very well. I was also thinking of the new David Hare play at the National I'm Not Running, which is another new play by a name writer. I mean, it's great in this country that we have these writers, Hare and McDonagh, whose names themselves draw people in it. You don't have to have Jim Broadbent, although that's a perk. But the David Hare play also is under par. And I just wonder kind of what's going on, that these great writers, and they are great writers, are just not working at a full tilt? Are people not being exacting enough with them? I don't know. It's a rhetorical question.
How interesting. Org, you've actually chosen a piece of literature.
Yes, I have. I was on the fence. I didn't know whether to choose this or a comedian called Jerry Sadowitz. I can sort of explain a little bit about both. But primarily, I think we wish to inform you that Tomorrow Will Be Killed With Our Families, which is a long form, it's novel length, magnificent piece of reportage by Philip Gurevich, which takes in the horror of the Rwandan genocide, contextualizes it, and stays with it for a few years afterwards, I think, talks about the follow-up issues, and basically offers this really, really acutely engaged, very sensitive, but also very moral and very writerly take on one of the worst horrors of our century, which this play makes the case that the Congolese genocide was, and it surely was. There's so much in genocide that needs to be discussed, and that this play doesn't really find the time to, and it's 80 minutes. We wish to inform you that Tomorrow Will Be Killed With Our Families is a spectacular work about that specific type of brutality.
And if one wants to talk about that particular incident, of course, then King Leopold's Ghost, a story of greed, terror and heroism in colonial Africa, is of course the Adam Hochschild book, which is absolutely tells what happens during that period of time. Of course, you've got Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad too, and a lot more recent stuff. There's also a place I wanted to point people to if the Congolese part of the story really interested them. So there's the Africa Museum in Tavur, and that's just outside Brussels, on the outskirts of Brussels. And I went to it in 2013, just before it closed down. And what it was trying to do was decolonize itself. It was this amazing museum, but it had all of King Leopold's Belgium there with all of the narrative that went with it in this kind of colonial language. It's been shut, and it actually opens in exactly a month's time, reopening to the public, now kind of completely contemporary. It's showing what happened in the Belgian Congo, as it was called then, and will now not be called, in this museum. And it really, I think, if people are interested in that side of the subject, will tell them a lot more. And of course, people can always go into Jim Broadbent's work to get an insight into his character by reading his graphic novel.
For sure, yeah. Dale Margaret definitely offers a glimpse into the spooky goings on in his mind.
So just to end, to have another broad sweep at this play, I put you on the spot, I know, and you say that perhaps one should save the money. But in terms of it being a theatrical experience, perhaps not for a critic of your standing.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I think one of the things that critics need to be aware of is that we don't generally pay for our tickets. We're given as a courtesy press tickets. That just goes to the professional terrain. And I know a lot of people who've paid for their tickets for this who were quite angry. So I think it's almost doubly important for the critic to say this is what it is, at least to me. And of course, anyone has the right to agree or disagree.
Mm. I was really interested by who was in the theatre. So quite often in the theatre, but quite often it's an older audience. Now, this because it was off West End, wasn't that? What's the demographic and why were they there?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, one of the last shows I saw was The Ferryman, which is a useful play to kind of offset this against. Jez Butterworth, his follow-up to Jerusalem, which was like a smash hit, directed by Sam Mendes. You know, unbelievable stage set, no expense spared, 2.5 hours of pure entertainment. And this is also kind of zeitgeisty, right? So there are going to be people like me who are familiar with McDonagh's work from film. Three Billboards made real waves when it came out. It was really feted. I have to say, nothing has quite matched up to In Bruges for me since he made that. Certainly not Seven Psychopaths, which was tedious beyond belief. But so I think maybe the fact is that for a lot of people, this might be their only outing to the theatre because it has this factor of recognisable names. It's in a cool theatre and, you know, it's not just going to attract people who see everything. And that's why I'm saying don't go, because there's other things to see if you're only going to see one thing this season.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about McDonagh is he's always had, and this is just intensified after Three Billboards, he's got a kind of hipster vibe. And so, yeah, I mean, there will be a lot of cool people at this who wouldn't have set foot probably near the Alan Bennett play that was there earlier this season, which would have had a much older, more typical demographic. Mm.
And just a quick word before we go about the venue itself, because, of course, it's a relatively new theatre. Nicholas Heitner is the man who set it up. Is it working?
The physical space is exactly a magnification of the Dorfman at the National, which Nick Hutton used to run. The Dorfman is the smallest of the National's three auditoriums, and this is the Dorfman times, I think, three, just in terms of size, but looks just like it. And I think it's a very attractive space. In terms of the work, I have to say, I think Nick Hutton has now been running it for a year. It's been disappointing. Their biggest hit so far has been a one-person play starring Laura Linney and a terrific immersive Julius Caesar. But a lot of the new writing has fallen short of the mark, and I wonder whether they're not going to have to be a bit more muscular about what they ask for from their writers.
Did you enjoy the space?
I loved the space, yeah. I really liked it. I mean, from a purely kind of night out perspective, really nice bar. I think it's catered by St. John's, which is never
a bad thing.
They've got Madeleines, they've got cheese straws.
You can smell the Madeleines when you walk in.
And it, you know, and the seat was comfortable and I had a great view and I didn't pay through the nose for it. I mean, it wasn't cheap, but it wasn't the end of the world expensive. So as an experience, it was great. Yeah.
Thank you both very much.
That brings
us to the end of today's show. So A Very, Very, Very Dark Matter is on at the Bridge Theatre in London until January the 6th. Tickets are available online. And very many thanks to Matt Wolfe and to Augustine Macellari. Thanks to Holly Fisher and to Bill Lutie. Do join us next time when Robert Bound will be back and looking at 90 years of Mickey Mouse. But until then, from me, Georgina Godwin, thanks for listening. And you know what? Go and see.